Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Chesterton Revisited with Professor Dermot Quinn, historian and Chesterton scholar. But first, as always at this time of week, we bring you There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, a programme presented each week by Jill Bevilacqua, which begins with Sean Patrick Lovett reading this week's Gospel for us.
Jesus said to his disciples, "Let your belts be fastened around your waists, and your lamps be burning ready. Be like men awaiting their master's return from a wedding, so that when he arrives and knocks, you will open for him without delay. It will go well with those servants whom the master finds wide awake on his return. I tell you, he will put on an apron, seat them at table, and proceed to wait on them. Should he happen to come at midnight or before sunrise and find them prepared, it will go well with them. You know as well as I that if the head of the house knew when the thief was coming, he would not let him break into his house. Be on guard, therefore. The Son of Man will come when you least expect him."
Although the language of today's translations is generally adapted to our modern ears, there's very little real difference in the wording of today's parable, for the meaning is so clear. The Jerusalem Bible version doesn't even refer to items of clothing, such as belts, but reads simply, "See that you are dressed for action." The earlier versions, such as the Vulgate and even the Revised Standard Version, use the phrase which is described today as poetic or literary, "Let your loins be girded or girt." And today's dictionary defines gird as to encircle or secure with a belt or band, often in the phrase to gird one's loins, meaning to prepare and strengthen oneself for what is to come. And a definition of 1450 reads simply to prepare oneself for action. A Bible scholar suggests that Jesus was recalling the night of the Passover, when the Israelites were ready for the long march towards the Promised Land, with their garments belted. They had been told how they were to eat that supper.
"You shall eat like this, with your loins girded, sandals on your feet, a staff in your hand."
Another writer comments, the biblical expression to gird up the loins meant to put on the girdle. It signified that the person was ready for service. On the other hand, to loose the girdle meant that the person was either lazy or resting.
"None of them faint or weary, none sleeping or drowsy, none of them with belt loose, none with sandal straps broken."
Thus Isaiah. Peter, in his first letter, uses the phrase, "having the loins of your mind girt up," which takes the idea of readiness even further. And Peter himself is shown on two occasions as unprepared, or taken by surprise. In the last chapter of John, when Jesus appears by the lakeside and calls to the apostles, and John to Peter whispers, "It is the Lord."
Simon Peter, when he heard that it was the Lord, girt his coat about him, for he was naked, and cast himself into the sea.
And a writer of biblical times tells us,
"Ordinarily, Jewish men wore an inner garment, an outer garment, a girdle, and sandals. The inner garment resembled a close-fitting shirt. The most common Hebrew word for this garment is translated variously as coat, robe, tunic, and garment. A man wearing only this inner garment was said to be naked."
Another famous occasion when Peter was caught unawares is recounted in the Acts of the Apostles. Herod had arrested Peter, and on the night before he was to be tried, this is what happened.
"Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, fastened with double chains, while guards kept watch at the main entrance to the prison. Then suddenly, the angel of the Lord stood there, and the cell was filled with light. He tapped Peter on the side and woke him. "Get up," he said. "Hurry." And the chains fell from his hands. The angel then said, "Put on your belt and sandals." After he'd done this, the angel next said, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me."
No blame can be attached to Peter, of course, for either of these occasions when he was found to be unready. Not a word we use, really, but it reminds me of an old nickname given to an English king, Ethelred II, who came to the throne in the year 978, must, write the historians, have been weak and indecisive. His nickname, the Unready, is a modern version or corruption of unraid or readeless, meaning poor counsel or evil counsel or unwise, whereas the name Ethelred meant noble counsel. Poor Ethelred, rather than unready, he seems to have been unlucky. In the second part of the opening to our Gospel, Jesus tells his disciples to have their lamps burning ready. This immediately calls to mind the other parable where lamps feature strongly, the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. Where today we have servants waiting for their master to return from a wedding, in the other parable, the virgins are awaiting for the bridegroom. But in each case, it's essential that the lamps be burning. For us who switch on a light effortlessly, the power of the image is greatly diminished. We have no need to remember to keep a supply of oil to fill the lamps when they burn low. But only a few centuries ago, the readers of John Milton's poem Comus wouldn't have found these lines so very strange.
O thievish night, why shouldst thou, but for some felonious end, in thy dark lantern thus close up the stars that nature hung in heaven and filled their lamps with everlasting oil to give due light to the misled and lonely traveller?
Not only the stars, but the sun and the moon have both been called lamps by the poets. Robert Herrick, in his most celebrated lyric, To Virgins to Make Much of Time, wrote, "The glorious lamp of heaven, the sun, the higher he's a-getting, the sooner will his race be run, and nearer he's to setting." And I well remember my mother playing the old ballad in those days when we all used to gather round the piano to sing, "The moon has raised her lamp above." But music and poetry aside, what is a lamp? Any of various devices for producing visible light, runs today's definition. But a 1933 dictionary has this description.
A vessel containing oil which is burnt at a wick for the purpose of illumination. Now also a vessel of glass or the like, enclosing a candle, oil, a gas jet, or an incandescent wire.
When those words were written, the incandescent wire of our common light bulb had been around for some 50 years. But not every household had electricity, confined indeed at first to the streets of cities. Until then, it had been up to the lamplighter to distribute starlight, as Robert Louis Stevenson put it.
The lamplighters took to their heels every evening and ran with a good heart, and though now and then an individual may have been knocked on the head by the ladder of the flying functionary, yet people taught their children to say, "God bless the lamplighter."
And to this popular character, Stevenson dedicated a children's poem.
My tea is nearly ready and the sun has left the sky. It's time to take the window to see Leary going by. For every night at tea time and before you take your seat, with lantern and with ladder he comes posting up the street.
And like all small boys, he dreams of doing the same when he grows up.
Oh, Leary, I'll go round at night and light the lamps with you.
But this was not to be. In A Plea for Gas Lamps, Stevenson writes of the man reflecting on progress. Out of the age of gas lamps, he glances back slightingly at the murk and glimmer in which his ancestors wandered. the era of oil lights, hard to kindle, easy to extinguish, pale and wavering in the hour of their endurance. When Stevenson wrote his essay, an experiment in street lighting by electricity had only just been made in Pall Mall, London, so he reflected, remembering Leary and mourning his passing.
For not much longer shall we watch him speeding up the street, and at measured intervals knocking another luminous hole into the dusk. Our tame stars are to come out in future, not one by one, but all in a body and at once. It is proposed that we should henceforth take our walks abroad in the glare of permanent lighting.
And such is this lightning glare in our cities today that astronomers must go to the desert to observe the stars. When the Israelites were journeying in the desert, their light was the pillar of fire, and to this day the Jews recall that time in the Feast of Tabernacles. In our Lord's day, on the first evening of the festival, golden lampstands were set up in the court of the women in the temple. Great candelabra, some 150 feet high, which the priests then lit as soon as darkness fell, while the crowd sang canticles, lighting innumerable other lights of every kind. It was, we're told, an occasion of riotous illumination. Perhaps Jesus himself had this feast in mind when, in the Sermon on the Mount, he used the images of a lamp to tell his disciples they were the light of the world.
No one lights a lamp to put it under a tub. They put it on the lampstand where it shines for everyone in the house. In the same way, your light must shine.
The lamps we must hold ready are for a different purpose, to welcome the return of the Master, and perhaps to help us stay awake. And there's that line from the psalm to remind us of what will keep us from stumbling.
Now your word is a lamp to my feet, a light on my path.
In the 16th century, it was not uncommon for a king or queen to announce at short notice that he or she would be your guest for the night. It paid to be always ready for such an announcement. An anonymous poet of the time describes what would most likely ensue, and adds a sober reflection. Let's close then with preparations.
Yet if His Majesty, our Sovereign Lord, should of His own accord friendly Himself invite, and say, I'll be your guest tomorrow night, how should we stir ourselves? Call and command, all hands to work, let no man idle stand. Set me fine Spanish tables in the hall, see they be fitted all. Let there be room to eat, and order taken, that there want no meat. See every sconce and candlestick made bright, that without tapers they may give a light. Look to the presents, are the carpets spread, the daisy o'er the head, the cushions in the chairs, and all the candles lighted on the stairs. Perfume the chambers, and in any case let each man give attendance in his place. Thus, if a king were coming, would we do, and 'twere good reason too, for 'tis a duteous thing to show all honour to an earthly king, and after all our travail and our cost, so he be pleased to think no labour lost. But at the coming of the King of Heaven, all set at 6 and 7, we wallow in our sin. Christ cannot find a chamber in the inn. We entertain him always like a stranger, and as at first, still lodge him in the manger.
Many thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for bringing us this edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. She'll be back again at this same time next week. And now on a different note, we are about to join Professor Dermot Quinn, historian and Chesterton scholar who's currently Associate Director of the Chesterton Institute for Faith and Culture, situated at Seton Hall University, New Jersey, in the United States. In a few moments, you can hear him place Chesterton into an historical context, while all the while highlighting his relevance in today's society. Stay tuned. Chesterton lived at a very exciting time in history.
He lived at a fascinating time. You know, he was born in 1874, he died in 1936, so he spanned the late Victorian, Edwardian and Georgian periods. He was someone who was absolutely at the centre of the journalistic debates of his time, the political debates of his time, the economic debates of his time. Chesterton is someone who is, I think, very much at the centre of the kind of debates that we are having in our time. So Chesterton was very much a person of his time in the late Victorian years, and I think he's a person of our time today.
The recent popes, or at least some of them, have certainly not forgotten him, have they?
Well, I am familiar with that. And of course, not only did Pope Benedict speak of Chesterton, but John Paul I, Papa Luciano, wrote very beautifully. Imaginary letter to Chesterton.
My dear Chesterton, you know as well as I, God is not like that, but is at once good and just. Father also to prodigal sons, not wanting us poor and wretched, but great, free, creators of our own destiny. Our God is so far from being man's rival that he wanted man to share in his own divine nature and in his own eternal happiness. And it's not true that he makes excessive demands of us. On the contrary, he is satisfied with little, because he knows very well that we do not have much. Dear Chesterton, I am convinced, as you are, this God will become more and more known and loved by everyone, including those who reject him today, not because they're wicked, they may be better than either of us, but because they look at him from a mistaken point of view. Do they continue not to believe in him? Then he answers, I believe in you.
Chesterton is a man of great lightness of touch. I mean, I think Papa Luciano was, of course, a very brief pope, but a beautifully cheerful pope, the smiling pope as we remember him. And I think that is something that he shares with Chesterton. Chesterton is someone who is able to speak very profoundly about complex and difficult things, but to do so in a way which is accessible, which is light, which is comical, which is funny, which is engaging. And I think that is why Chesterton is so much a prophet, I think, for today. So many things that Chesterton can say to our world, and to say those things in an attractive and humorous and comical way.
But Chesterton is difficult to approach, I think, because he was such a prolific writer. Maybe there are other reasons as well, though you say that he is accessible to people.
I think he is accessible. He was greatly beloved in his own time. I mean, he was an enormously popular journalist. People read his column every week in the Daily News or in the Illustrated London News or whatever. So he wrote specifically for the general public. So it seems to me he's someone who is quite easy to access, to be in touch with. But you're quite right that some of the ideas that he's exploring are really quite difficult to get our heads around. I mean, he was a great popularizer of St. Thomas. He regarded St. Thomas as one of the greatest of all saints because of his intellectual work. Thomas is a difficult man to understand if you read him, you know, as a philosopher. On the other hand, someone like Chesterton could take the ideas of St. Thomas and render them in a form which was really quite available to many, many people. He wrote a small biography of St. Thomas, and the great Thomist philosopher Etienne Gilson said that...
The Frenchman said that
this was the greatest book on St. Thomas ever written.
Which is amazing.
It is amazing, and Chestertonians like to quote that. I mean, Gilson might have been slightly exaggerating, of course, but he considered that to be one of the greatest works ever written about St. Thomas. And Chesterton, if you like, understood St. Thomas from the inside. He had somehow understood the very depths of St. Thomas's intellectual life and is able to convey that to a popular audience. And I think that's just tremendously impressive.
Of course, they shared a great body, didn't they, both of them?
Well, that is certainly true.
And joy, and that joyful.
Well, that's quite right. Chesterton said at the end of his great work, Orthodoxy, that joy is the gigantic secret of the Christian. And certainly Chesterton was a big man, and St. Thomas was a big man, and I always like to think that fat men are particularly devoted to the doctrine of the Incarnation.
Of course, Chesterton, sometimes we forget that he was a convert, no?
He was a convert, and...
A convert to Catholicism from...
From Anglicanism. Chesterton's intellectual or his spiritual journey is a slightly complicated one. His family didn't seem to have very much religion. He was kind of from a Unitarian background, then went through a phase of non-belief, where he had a kind of mental breakdown in many ways. Someone like St. Thomas and the ideas of Thomas, which brought him round to recognizing once again the goodness of the world, the reality of God in material things, that kind of sacramental way of understanding reality. So he became an Anglican and was converted to Church of Rome, to the Roman Catholic faith in 1922. But in many ways he was Catholic in his intellectual and spiritual life long before he was actually received into the Church.
And he inspired other people to convert.
He was very much the inspirer of many, many people to rediscover the joy of Christianity.
You said that earlier that Chesterton didn't believe, but then he wrote Orthodoxy, which is in contrast with darkness, in a sense, isn't it?
That's right. And Orthodoxy is his recognition that he had been walking in a dark place, personally and intellectually and spiritually, and he was seeking a philosophy. He was trying to find some philosophy, trying, if you like, to invent some philosophy. And it suddenly dawned on him that this philosophy was there all along, and it was Christian Orthodoxy. Christian Orthodoxy explained the world in a way that nothing else could explain the world, and it was, as he said, like a key fitting into a lock. Everything clicked, everything made sense. Every doctrine, every dogma seemed to speak to some particular experience that he had. The reality of the world, the reality of evil, the redemption of Christ, all of these things which he had been struggling about in his own dark place suddenly became clear when he looked at Christian Orthodoxy. And as he said in the very first page of that famous book, Orthodoxy, it's not my philosophy. God and humanity made it, and it made me. Very, very beautiful words, I think.
So he's an author who has so many facets. It's unbelievable. He also believed in the power of imagination and wonder related to faith, no?
I think wonder is a key idea in Chesterton. He said, again in Orthodoxy, that the great challenge to the philosopher is to be at once at home in the world and utterly astonished by it. To be at home in the world and to be astonished by it. Chesterton never lost that sense of astonishment, of wonder, and of gratitude for the reality of existence itself. So all of his life he is expressing a kind of hymn of praise for his own existence and for existence itself. It's a kind of childlike wonder. Chesterton was in some respects, a child, a very big child as he grew older. He loved children. He loved childish things. He had a toy theatre. It was a sort of beautiful childhood spirituality. Chesterton had that sense of wonder and gratitude. And again, to get back to your point, that is really a facet of his imagination. I mean, that he can imagine, even as a man, the world as seen by a child. It's a wonderful gift, and very often I think we lose it.
You describe him then as a timeless author.
I think he is. I think he speaks to our time. I think he spoke certainly to his own time. He speaks in very practical ways about things like the economy, things like the need for a humane social order, the importance of the family, the importance of community. His economic vision is sometimes called distributism, which is very much in keeping with the ideas of, for example, Pope Leo XIII in Rerum Novarum.
Which stemmed from the Industrial Revolution, in a sense.
Very much so. In a world where you had kind of crushing poverty and the industrial working classes without really much in the way of hope or dignity. Chesterton and Pope Leo XIII argued about the importance of private ownership, of people having their own property, their own independence. Chesterton, I think, developed this idea, was consciously in the debt of Pope Leo XIII, and those are ideas which Pope John Paul II, of course, developed very much in his own magnificent social encyclicals, Centesimus Annus, and so on.
So, what do you like personally most about Chesterton?
I like his humour, I like his humanity, I like his gratitude, I like his paradoxes. He is, for me, as for many people, a kind of friend that I never met. He is an enormously genial, affectionate, funny man who has seen very deep things and has understood those very deep things and has conveyed those deep things in a light and beautiful way.
In June of 1936, Ronald Knox said at Chesterton's funeral, I think it was in Westminster Cathedral, "All of this generation has grown up under Chesterton's influence so completely that we do not even know when we are thinking Chesterton." Do you think this corresponded to the truth at the time?
I think in some respects it did. Obviously, a man preaching a funeral sermon is perhaps engaged in a slight bit of exaggeration. But Chesterton was a profoundly influential figure in his day. He was, as I've said, a journalist whose journalism was read with great avidity, great interest. Chesterton spoke to many, many people, some of whom were not Catholic, many were not Catholic, but he conveyed to them something of the Catholic imagination, something of the Catholic vision. So I think that Monsignor Knox was quite accurate in the way in which he depicted Chesterton's influence in his day. He was simply an enormous figure, as you say, physically, but also intellectually. He had a huge impact on the England of his day.
Of course, he described himself as a rollicking journalist. How does that come together with the Christian ideal that he actually wrote about?
Oh, well, he certainly wouldn't have thought that there was any incompatibility between enjoying a pint of beer and being a Christian. God speaks to us materially, and Chesterton believed in pleasure. He believed in joy, he believed in companionship, he believed in friendship, and all of those things are God's gift to us. Chesterton, if you like, exemplified, or so to speak, incarnated his own gospel of pleasure and friendship.
And you were listening there to Professor Dermot Quinn, historian and Chesterton scholar, who's currently Associate Director of the Chesterton Institute for Faith and Culture, situated in Seton Hall University, New Jersey, United States. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget that we won't be back again at this same time tomorrow, but we will be back again at this same time next weekend. Meanwhile, if you wish to listen to the rest of our programming, do check out our website. The address is www.rv.va and then click on the English World icon. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.